Welcome to the Walk a Mile in My Shoes podcast, a podcast where I want you, my loyal listener, to enter into the world of my guests, try on the footwear for a size, and immerse yourself in their lives for a time. I'm your host, Chris Young, and in this episode, I have the privilege of speaking to Sonia Cowling, a psychiatrist who has a lived experience of mental ill health. We talk about a load of stuff, from the lack of mental health services to the weird juxtaposition of coercion and care, to her thoughts on trauma and the personality disorder label. I follow her on Twitter, and I've got to say I rather like the cut of her jib. The tweet that, for me, sums her up best is when she said, "I want to become a person that builds things. I want to move from complaining and pointing out flaws to suggesting new ideas, working to start positive things and taking steps to make them happen." Hello, Sonia. Welcome to the Walk a Mile in My Shoes podcast.
Hi, Chris. It's really, really nice to be here with you.
Yeah, really appreciate you giving up your time to come along and talk. Now, the thing that I tend to ask people is, instead of me rabbiting on about who I think you are, how would you describe yourself for my listener?
So I am a doctor by training, a medical doctor, and I'm training in psychiatry in the northwest of England. I have a background of trying to do a bit of nursing whilst I was still living in my home country. So I come from Finland and I trained there, did a year of nursing that decided it wasn't for me, and moved on to medical school then. And I moved to the UK after having finished my medical degree and stayed at home with the kids for quite a few years until then, moving on to do my foundation training and then psychiatry training. So I'm sort of about halfway my psychiatry training. Right. I've worked in mental health pretty much my whole life since I was about 17, 18. I'm now 37, so right, for right. About 20 years.
So was that including the nursing?
Yeah, so it was by chance, actually. I got my first ever job as a 17-year-old, and I got a cleaning job in a hospital, and it just happened to be on a psychiatric ward older people. And then it was just kind of from there. I was first a domestic, then I just worked throughout all school holidays as a domestic, then a healthcare support worker, and then as a nurse student, and then a medical student, and then obviously now as a doctor.
Interesting. So I suppose this splits into two questions. Why mental health? Why would you work in mental health?
I think it was kind of two combined things. So I had, since from being quite young, I always wanted to be in a caring profession.
Right.
I think first I thought I'd want to be a nurse and then a doctor, and it was kind of, I hadn't really thought about mental health as a career until I started cleaning on that ward.
Okay.
And I found the stories of the people who were living there as patients just absolutely fascinating. And I started reading more about mental health. And then I started struggling with my own mental health as right. a 14-year-old. And that's been kind of a lifelong thing, really. So I suffer with recurrent depression. And so I think it was a combination of that I was quite a poorly teenager, and that then got me reading more about it as well, kind of trying to understand what was going on for me. So it was a combined thing, really. It was almost like these two separate things that I was interested on a personal level, but then the work kind of got me interested on a more kind of like scientific level too.
That's interesting.
And then I just decided to combine those two, I suppose.
So that leads to the next question, and I'm glad you didn't answer the question in yours. Is why psychiatry?
I think that was, again, kind of like, I've kind of almost regretted not thinking about psychology.
Right.
But I was always really, really fascinated, equally fascinated of the human body as well as the human mind. But then again, I suppose you could argue that they're not really separate things anyway. So I went into medical school because I loved kind of human biology at high school. And just love the physical aspect as well as their so then it just then kind of naturally it's hard to actually think, because the psychology one just never kind of crossed my mind. I thought about mental health nursing, so when I started nursing, that was my goal, to become a mental health nurse, because in Finland those are not a separate degree, so nursing is nursing. There is no separate mental health nursing, just at the end of it then you decide where you want to work, but then when I went into medical school, I did kind of know from the day one that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. But I think I had a very different view of how psychiatrists work compared with how they maybe work here.
Right, right. I mean, is it? Do you think it's different in Finland from here?
So very different. So first of all, it's not the system is not like a kind of like here in psychiatry. There's a very clear ladder of hierarchy,
right,
which is not quite clear in Finland. So in Finland, medical students start working as psychiatrists already during their studies. So as long as you finished your psychiatry course as a fourth year medical school student, you can start then working during your holidays. So I did as a I think fourth or fifth year medical student. So that's during the summer holidays for 2 months, I worked as kind of like their psychiatrist was off on their summer holidays. And I replaced them for 2 months.
Wow, as a student?
Yes, as a student. So it's thought of very differently. You've got amazing support and they kind of just trust you to only do what you feel capable of doing. But I did everything that the psychiatrist would have done as well. And to be honest, it wasn't really a struggle, that it kind of, to me, this might sound... Yeah, I don't know. It just, to me, it wasn't kind of, I mean, looking back now, I was writing kind of like statements to courts and that sort of things, which seems ridiculous now, because that definitely has
it's a lot of power, isn't
skill
it?
To
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, it was more kind of, I did a lot of assessments for who kind of comes to CMHD and who doesn't. And that was quite straightforward really there, because they had like a point system of, you know, of what kind of symptoms you had to have. And then I did a lot of assessments for kind of like psychotherapy. And again, that you didn't really say no to anyone. So if a patient came to you and said, I'd really like to have some psychotherapy, you just say, okay, I'll write a statement for you and you can go and get psychotherapy. So it was just, so how it works in Finland is if a person is struggling from kind of mental health problems and they want to get psychotherapy, they come and see a psychiatrist, right, who will write a statement on why they would benefit from psychotherapy, and then the state funds the psychotherapy for them. So they might have to pay like 5 or 10 euros per session themselves. I can't quite remember how much it is, or whether you always have to pay that,
right,
but then you get funded psychotherapy, and it can be anything from between 1 to 3 sessions a week, and the length of it is between 1 to 3 years.
Wow! Wow!
Yeah.
So, and does it start? I guess when it needs to start, does it start?
Yeah. So the patient then goes and finds their own psychotherapist.
Right.
So there's a long list for each town of qualified psychotherapists. And then they just go and call a psychotherapist, says, could I come for a session to see if we could work together? And then if they decide they'll work with that specific psychotherapist, then that gets paid for by the state.
Wow.
So in that sense, you know, you'd think that, oh, you were doing assessments for psychotherapy as a student, but it wasn't really a thorough assessment of like their psychological maturity or readiness. It was more just kind of, these are the things that this person struggles with. This is what they're telling me. And I feel like they would benefit from psychological therapy. So it was quite simple, really.
Right. Do you think we overcomplicate it here?
Yes, definitely. 100%. Because I think, well, we know from a lot of research anyway, that it's the relationship that matters in mental health difficulties.
Yeah.
And yet we all have these really, really long training and degrees of kind of like how to do all these complicated things. And yet patients are all saying the same thing, just listen to me care, and that's all that matters really.
Yes, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, I do feel a little bit like that because, you know, when I was working at the, so I did 1 month of CMHT psychiatry and 1 month of emergency psychiatry. So in Finland as well, patients don't go to A&E in a mental health crisis. They go to these emergency psychiatry departments, which are either connected with mental health hospitals or then with CMHTs. So you can either get referred by a GP or you can just walk in and say, I'm really struggling. And then somebody will assess you there and then decide what happens. And in that one where I worked for 1 month, you'd kind of, I'd see a patient, do an assessment, and then either they'd go into hospital or they'd get referred to a CMHD or they'd go back to their GP. Or if I felt like they needed support at the moment for this crisis, I could myself see them for up to 10 times,
okay,
just to sort of help them through that crisis.
With the transition, right, okay.
Yeah, and I didn't have to kind of justify that I'm a medical doctor, so they need to have a medical need. I could just kind of provide the very straightforward psychological support.
So why don't we do that here?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. I don't know. I suppose it's all very medicalized in a way. And I suppose, I don't know, sometimes I wonder as well whether we've kind of lost a bit of common sense, that everything has to be evidence-based, which I get.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we just do these, like, just so much research into everything. And there's all these policies and risk assessments and this and that. And it's just become so big. And I mean, how do you scale back from that, when something much more simple could be, I suppose, probably more cost effective and more helpful?
I mean, it does sound incredibly labor intensive what we do here. I mean, certainly as being part of of the system, I was assessed by my doctor, I was assessed by a mental health worker, then I was assessed by a mental health team, and then I was put on a waiting list for 2 years. For talking therapies, and the assessment process felt a lot like a justification as to why I didn't need that service immediately. Mm-hmm. and it just felt, I don't know, strange. It felt, you know, I think a lot of people here in the UK just aren't getting the service when they need it. You know, that feels, you know, it feels like things get a lot worse, and by the time you reach therapy, you're in bits.
I totally agree, and I was in a similar circumstances to yourself.
Sure.
I was on a waiting list, I think, for two years or something, and then I decided to go privately, and obviously I was lucky enough to be able to do that. I think it's just absolutely awful that if you're kind of not in a financial kind of like stability that where you can afford to go privately. Then the only option is to wait for really long times. And I think what kind of like gets sometimes misunderstood is because patients get a lot of the no's, and like you say, it often feels like the assessment process is kind of like trying to justify that you don't need this.
Yeah.
Is that I see it from both
of course,
sides really.
Of course, yeah.
So I see that the professionals that I've worked with have like huge majority of them are like kind people who genuinely do their jobs because they want to help people with their distress. But then what they face is that they have these huge caseloads, and people who assess the patients coming in know that we've got the limited number of patients that we can look after and a huge number of referrals coming in. And then you kind of in that, and I've done those assessments myself where I've gone to my supervisor and said, this patient to me really needs our support. And then I've been told that, yes, I agree, but we can't, you know, if we took all the patients on this level of distress, we wouldn't be able to provide everybody the care. So we have to raise the threshold to this level of care, because otherwise it's not just not kind of possible with the finances that there are.
Is it that scientific, or do you get a feeling that there's a lot of subjectivity in that decision making?
There's a lot of subjectivity, I'd agree, but then again, the levels of kind of, there's definitely subjectivity. It's not like scientific in a sense, but I'd say that the people who assess do kind of then see the level of kind of like struggles that the patient have. And I feel like the level of distress, both for children and adults, that you need to have to actually qualify for CMHD is so incredibly high that you have to be already kind of like functioning really, really poorly before you kind of qualify. But although, to be honest, that hugely varies as well, because my own experience has not been like that at all. That I've always kind of gone to my GP sort of fairly early on saying, I think I'm starting to struggle, and I've been able to get through to CMHT straight away and had really just, I would say, excellent care. So I'm not sure if it's because of my profession or whether I have heard that the team that I'm under is meant to be very, very good, and my doctor is very good. So I think there's quite huge differences nationally as well between areas and teams.
Are you happy to talk about your mental health?
To some extent, yeah. Obviously.
Just tell me to get lost whenever you feel the urge. But when you say you knew when it was time to approach your GP, what did that look like for you? What was going on?
I tend to normally just know that I'm kind of like the normal me, well me, is very, very bubbly and positive and energetic. And so I know that when I start losing interest in things and start having a bit kind of like cynical thoughts at work and thinking quite gloomily about things, really, then I know that I'm heading for a depressive episode. And also, I suppose at work, my kind of like level of productivity goes down.
Sure.
So it'll take me a longer time to get through, say, writing a discharge letter or whatever I'm doing.
Gosh, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, certainly as a social worker, I was a social worker for about 1,000 years. Very similar. Very similar. You suddenly you feel like you're sort of wading through sludge, and it's a challenge. The reason, just hopping back to the waiting list thing, the reason I ask, certainly in social work, I always felt we weren't reaching the people who needed it most. We weren't assertively going out there and seeking them. We were waiting for referrals to come in, and good God, did referrals come in. But my feeling was there was a large amount of people out there who weren't shouting, who weren't calling for help, who needed us most. And I was quite interested to come across assertive outreach in psychiatry. I don't know if you've come across that at all.
I've never worked with those teams, but it's only actually via Twitter that I've come across people who work in those teams, and I think they sound absolutely amazing. So my experience around this is probably a little bit limited because we rotate every 6 monthly.
Right.
So my UK experience, so I've obviously got a lot of experience from Finland as well, but I have to say that that's obviously in a different country, plus it was over 10 years ago. So I think things might have changed there as well. But in the UK, as trainees, we rotate every 6 monthly. So most of my jobs have been 6 month slots. So that gives you kind of quite a limited picture of that one area. But if I kind of like think about in general, the different specialities where I've worked, it does kind of give a similar picture from everywhere that patients have to be willing to kind of come to the appointments and be really motivated to change,
yeah.
which is obviously not always very easy with mental health.
No.
And I know for myself as well that there can be kind of like a temptation to just think, well, it doesn't matter, especially if you're really depressed. You can think, it doesn't really matter. I'll just stay at home. Or there can be like very depressive thoughts thinking, I think this is common for lots of problems, to thinking I'm not worthy of care or help.
Yeah.
And there can be lots of barriers to seeking help. So then if those people are not kind of helped, it doesn't quite sit right with me.
And
I suppose, again, it's tricky with the funding to then go out.
I guess what then, and when you do finally seek services and then the services don't engage with you, then that just confirms your negative thoughts about services. You think, well, why did I bother in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. It is a bit of a mess.
It is. It must be very difficult working in the system just now. You know, from my perspective, you know, I've been dabbling in it for, I don't know, 30 odd years, and it feels like things haven't been this bad ever. And I would suggest a lot of that is down to funding.
Yeah. And I get a similar feel. And kind of when I look at my colleagues, both psychiatrists and mental health nurses, I'd say people are quite burnt out. And, you know, the number of patients that everybody has on their caseloads is just often undoable in lots of areas. And people are quite, I think, in the places where I've worked, especially nursing staff, they're really, really tired, really demoralised, and that will obviously affect how they work with patients as well.
It was interesting. I was having a bit of a scan at your Twitter feed, and one of the things that jumped out was a quote from Dr. Chloe Beale. Our services are fortresses. Patients are to be prevented from breaching our defences. Sorry, patients are intruders to be prevented from breaching our defences. And that kind of felt like it summed up all the services.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, it's depressing, but that has been my experience quite a lot as well. And I think that close article really just, really resonated with me.
I absolutely
loved what she was saying. I know it's really divided. People have been on some WhatsApp groups where kind of psychiatry trainees have had quite differing opinions around the article and themes in it.
Right, interesting.
Yeah.
I suppose if you're investing a lot of time into becoming a professional in that area, then it is very difficult to accept some criticism. Because it feels like it's a personal attack.
Yeah, probably. And I think it's funny because I've noticed, I think kind of with my own psychotherapy journey, I've sort of learned a lot about how difficult it can be for us as humans to hold both good and bad at the same time. And I think that kind of applies here as well, that it seems to be really difficult for people to kind of say that there are, you know, there is good and bad in all of us.
Yeah.
And that's the same applies to the services, that there can be really good things about the services, but there can also be really bad, horrendous things.
Yeah, shocking.
And that, you know, if we're saying that they don't work for a lot of people, it doesn't mean that they don't work for some people.
That's right.
And that there isn't kind of genuine attempts to make it good.
Yeah. I think I've been guilty of that in the past. I think I was a bit evangelical against mental health medication. And I guess I still believe that mental health medication, for all its fancy rhetoric, is pretty much a group of painkillers. From antipsychotics to antidepressants, they numb pain, and God, they do it really well. You know, to be fair, you know, I have been rescued from, taking my own life from taking medication. But I think sometimes we don't consider the future impact of those medications. You know, I think we can focus a bit too much on fighting the fire at the time, and we're not too worried about the water damage that we're doing.
I agree, and I feel like I'm still sort of, I don't quite know what to think about it. I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
I've seen how much medications have helped people. I've seen people come into hospital so unwell, kind of like lost all their dignity, where they're sort of like smearing their feces everywhere, running around naked, they've lived in absolute squalor, you know, in a way that no human should. And they're like screaming in absolute like agony and agitation. And then they get the medication and the difference is just unbelievable. And plus there's kind of a difference between different kind of mental health conditions as well. So somebody, for example, with bipolar, I think will look very, very different in presentation and kind of what helps and what's causing their symptoms compared with somebody who's got complex trauma history.
Sure, sure.
So I feel like it's just very complex. So I would definitely not say that medication is the cure for everything, or, well, it's not really a cure for anything, that kind of, that it would be the ultimate help for everything. But then I wouldn't go as far as to say that medications are bad and we should look at it, like, you know, just ditch the medication and use just other
methods. Agree. I think the middle ground is a great place to be. I guess the route there I was going down was iatrogenic harm, and I'm thinking about the, you know, even with the best intentions, sometimes we, because of lack of time, lack of resources, lack of insight, we harm people when we're trying to do well by them.
Oh, definitely. And I think where my thoughts go with this medication issue is that I wish there were more options, that we were able to listen to our patients and just offer more options, that it wouldn't always be medication.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you could kind of offer, even with somebody with kind of like severe symptoms that we call kind of psychotic type symptoms, you know, if we were able to provide sort of safe places that were actually therapeutic environments, instead of these scary hospital wards that are very chaotic and very clinical. And I just wonder, I know there's been some great work done by is it Soteria Network who are kind of looking at alternative ways of looking at psychosis.
We had therapeutic communities for a while, but they seem to have, they're no longer fashionable, they've lost funding, they no longer exist, which is kind of sad because they seem to be terribly effective.
That's exactly the thing that I've heard. So I've spoken to multiple medical psychotherapists, and actually my own psychotherapist, who is not a medic, he set up a therapeutic community as well with kind of a farming theme.
Brilliant.
And all of these people that I've spoken to who've been involved in therapeutic communities have just raved about them.
Right.
They've said they were so effective. Patients absolutely loved them. The results were great, but eventually the funding was always taken away from them. And it just seems so difficult to understand, doesn't it?
I suppose with the firefighting model, you crisis care, I think, is very expensive. And because we're spending so much money on crises, we're not able to look at the long term. We struggle to look at the long term, I guess.
That's true. But I do often wonder about whether the system has just gotten too big as well.
Mm.
Because when I think this is, I'm not sure if it's kind of the similar sort of theme, that whether things have gotten to this sort of size in Finland as well now, and whether it was smaller 10 years ago in England as well. But when I look at my own experiences working in, say, a psychiatry ward, so what a psychiatry ward in Finland looked like 10 years ago, we had a psychiatrist or two, mental health nurses, occupational therapists. Then there were various other, there was normally an art therapist, a music therapist, various professionals like this. There were no medics that, so physical health care was not part of the care,
right.
You know, that, that was dealt with somewhere else. But as well as that, you'd maybe have one medical secretary, but not always. And that was pretty much it. Whilst now, the units where I've worked, they are huge units. So we've got all sorts of professionals. There's loads of admin staff. There's mental health law office. There's, you know, all these things. I have no idea what they even do. We've got communications departments.
Right.
And, you know, like all sorts of things. And we're bombarded with these ridiculous amounts of emails saying, do you know about Wellbeing Week? And do you know about this? And take part in this. And just going through your emails.
Yeah.
It's like a job itself, and the staff are drowning in all of that, like doing all these audits and filling in questionnaires and doing compulsory training and reading your emails. And
all the time you've got a bazillion patients to work
with. Yeah, exactly. And what I see, especially in inpatient units, is that the staff is spending, especially the qualified, so the more qualified the staff are, the more time they are spending in the office, staring at their laptop, filling in paperwork, documenting, and the time that they actually get to spend with patients doing the jobs that they actually love is so much smaller compared with that.
That's brilliant. So technically, the more skilled you've become as a professional, the less time you get to spend with
patients. Absolutely. And it's not even jobs like managing, you know, leadership and managing your team and kind of like making sure that everything's running smoothly. It's not just jobs like that. It's kind of like very tasks that seem very meaningless to me, and risk assessments. And it's, it just seems bizarre that we're obsessed with risk and obsessed with this and that. But then again, it comes from the culture of kind of then when things do go wrong, then the professionals are find themselves in court, which is not the case in Finland. So
right.
Or it wasn't 10 years ago. It could be today.
Yeah,
it kind of, risk was something that we talked about and that we documented, but there was definitely no like separate risk assessments and no feeling of that sort of panic of like, what if something goes wrong? What are we going to do?
I think that that's key, the whole risk assessment thing. And I'm doing some work on risk at the moment. And one of the things that sort of I stumbled across, which was absolutely gobsmacking, was it was a study of suicide in 2018 in the UK. And of the 1,538 deaths by suicide of folk who'd been in touch with mental health services, people who'd been in touch with mental health services the previous 12 months, 88% of them had been judged as no immediate risk of suicide by clinicians at their final service contact. So 88% of people were seen as low or no immediate risk. I think that the tools that we're using are faulty. I mean, 88% is...
It's huge.
Yeah. So I think we need to reassess risk.
I think we kind of know it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, I think we need to reassess risk. But you say you think we know it.
I think we do, that we do know that there's not a reliable way of predicting the risk. But again, I just wonder whether it could be something a lot more simple, and whether it... I just think that if we had a society that was more nurturing and supportive, you know, we wouldn't have this extreme poverty and wealth gaps and, you know, just, I suppose, a healthier society, healthier mental health systems, then maybe we wouldn't be at this point. But it's difficult. These are complex things, and it's difficult to know what's right or wrong.
I think you're right. I think it's important not to think about, just your mental health silo that you're working in, that Yeah, even within mental health services, that you're not the only mental health service in town. There's the NHS, and then there's the police, and then there's physical health services. Who, like you say, casualty, accident, and emergency is where people come in. I mean, that would be a great change, surely, if we had an accident and emergency, an emergency department purely for people with mental ill health or mental health crisis or whatever you'd like to describe it. It sounds so sensible in...
Yeah, I totally agree. I struggle to understand why it is like it is at the moment. I mean, fair enough for people who have taken an overdose and really need to be there be checked out. But I think anything else, if it is purely distress, I really struggle to understand why we haven't got kind of like places where people can walk in and be seen straight away. Because, I mean, they'd still have to be seen straight away in A&Es.
Yes.
So why those same teams can't see them in a different place and give that space then in A&E for the people who need the physical health care?
And I wonder... people I've spoken to a lot that prejudice and stigma exists quite heavily in A&E, with the attitude
absolutely.
Of, you know, we've got real patients to look after, we've got people with physical illness to look after.
My experience from A&E was that because I felt myself to be a much better mental health doctor than a physical health doctor, because that was where my experience was. And when I worked in A&E, there was a little mark that they put in the patient's next to the patient's name on the board.
Yes.
That meant that this is a mental health problem. And when I used to see that mark, I felt like a sense of relief.
Right.
That this is stuff that I know what I'm doing.
Okay.
I feel like I'm fairly good at this. And I used to love it. And the other staff used to think I was crazy. They said, "You are joking," that my heart sinks when I see that sign there, that they just didn't feel like they had the skills or time or kind of like, yeah, they just didn't feel like they knew how to deal with people in mental health crisis.
So because they didn't have the skills, do you feel, and I'm leading the witness here, that built prejudice against...
Yeah, definitely, because it then becomes like this sort of dark humour around mental health patients. That's, I feel, is totally inappropriate and quite cruel at times. I can't see that it is working very well at all.
The frustrating thing for me as well is that people who most require mental health training don't go on mental health training.
Very true.
There's no feeling of it being mandatory or...
No. But I do wonder whether the kind of like good solution would be then that it would be sort of separate from A&E, so that people who actually want to do the job and are qualified to do the job look after the people who need the help. Because it does seem just very cruel that we say, oh, yes, seek the help and, you know, we'll be there for you. And then you go to A&E when you're treated
as opposed to my as opposed to my coercive model where you will learn about mental health. No, that's fair enough. which got me thinking about coercion in mental health services. One of the things that really slapped me in the face recently was the high intensity network and Serenity Integrated Mentoring. Did you come across that in your travels?
Unfortunately, I did. Yeah, I wish I hadn't had to hear about it.
Yeah,
it's something that I've found really, really difficult to hear about. I've kind of, I have come across the teams. I've not worked with these teams, but I've kind of come across them whilst on my lunch break, chatting to these teams and trying to sort of understand the reasons behind it. And I have to say, I struggle.
What can you say what kind of work they were doing, just for the sake of the listener?
So I understand. So my like knowledge around this is very limited, but from what I was explained, what's that? There are some patients or service users who they feel use the emergency services and, yeah, especially emergency services kind of inappropriately. So that there were patients who were calling the ambulance 8 times a day,
right,
or attending the A&E kind of like a really high numbers of times. And this was kind of came as a result. So they talked about support, but there was also a lot of talk about consequences,
sure,
which to me equals punishment, really.
Yeah.
And kind of talk about the potential to even prosecute people who they felt were using the emergency services inappropriately. But to me, this again comes back to, well, why are these people doing this?
Yes.
What are the needs that are not being met, yes, by mental health services,
yeah,
that result in them having to do this? And involving police and prosecution just seems so unbelievably inappropriate. And again, cruel. It's difficult to understand.
Yeah, it felt kind of, yeah, difficult to understand. I mean, I was looking at it from a purely financial point of view, and people were being, on this program, were being visited by a social worker and a police officer twice a week for 2 hours to, yeah, be under this behavioural umbrella.
Yeah.
That's astonishingly expensive. I can't imagine, yeah, how much a 2 hour visit, you know, this must have been at least £600 a week for,
yeah,
for that input.
Yeah.
And
if you imagine they would get that same 4 hours with a qualified psychologist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. So it felt punitive. It felt the result of prejudice.
Yes. Yes. And I heard the kind of the explanations behind this from some staff members were that, these are people who refuse to engage with mental health services, but it's difficult to know, you know, is that really the case? It could be that,
yeah,
this is true, that this is,
yeah,
people who,
yeah,
have been offered every single,
yeah,
help possible and they're just not engaging. But I've also heard from patients' point of view of people who've been refused help,
yes,
all over and over again, and then finally they get a visit from the police.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think with something like that, even if they are justifying it by saying that this is purely for people who won't engage but keep kind of calling the ambulance inappropriate numbers a day and sort of put a real strain on the services, it's just kind of, where will you draw the line then? How,
yeah,
do you say, who are these people, and how are we going to make sure that this is definitely how it goes, that this is definitely never, ever going to be applied to anybody outside of these brackets, that it's not going to be for somebody who struggled to access help for various reasons, or the services have not been able to provide the appropriate help, and then it's used as a punitive way.
Yeah,
so it just doesn't sit right with me at all.
It doesn't feel safe, no.
No.
So... On the subject, I guess, of coercion, I always thought it must be terribly difficult. I've got a friend who is he's a lecturer. He's also he'd been a mental health nurse for forever, and one of the weird things was the having to work with somebody therapeutically when you're detaining them.
Yeah,
and
that is really difficult.
That must be a real challenge.
It is, and it's something that I've really battled with. I've luckily had lots of placements where that's not been part of the job at all, but I have also had lots of jobs where that has definitely been part of the job, that somebody, it's off, yeah, there's multiple different difficult situations. So there's the situations where somebody is detained under a section on the ward, and they really, really do not want to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, again, difficult, especially when the wards are not, to me, they are not often a very therapeutic environment.
Sure.
So then for somebody extremely distressed and unwell, it must be absolutely terrifying. So I do struggle with that aspect. I think I would maybe find it a little bit easier to sit with it if they were very therapeutic environments.
Right.
But then also seclusion of people, which again, kind of, I've seen the situations and the seclusions normally happen when somebody has already hurt other people and is kind of threatening to hurt people again. So where I've worked, it wasn't used lightly, but yeah, still yeah. The seclusion suites are, it's just basically a room with a mattress, and to be detaining somebody extremely distressed in an environment like that is just horrendous.
Yes.
And same for the 136 suites where people come in really distressed. Although I've seen, I'd say with 136 suites, I've seen more good, mainly good practice in that it often tends to be the lovely healthcare support workers who sit there with them, and the people where I've seen it used haven't been shut in a room. They've been sitting in an armchair in the same room with a healthcare support worker. Okay. They're given a cup of tea. They chat about all sorts, to music.
Right.
And it's been kind of quite a warm environment. But still, to be sitting there in that little box of a room, already distressed, knowing that the doors are locked, it must be absolutely horrendous.
I think to call it a suite is probably... a stretch of the imagination, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They are not nice places.
No. I don't know. There are so many questions around that. So when you're detaining somebody, can you tell us a bit more what 136 means?
So 136 is basically like a legal way to detain somebody who's a risk to themselves or others.
Right.
So police can then, somebody who's in a lot of mental distress, but also kind of tends to pose a risk to themselves or others. So often it's people who have maybe been in a situation where they've been very close to hurting themselves more often than hurting others. And then police brings them to a place of safety, which is the 136 suite, as we call it. So it's a place of safety. It's basically where I've worked. It's been kind of two rooms combined, where there's a bed and a bathroom, and then another room with sofas. And then the other room is kind of the room with a mattress or the bed, and the bathroom is kind of lockable. So if the patient gets so agitated that they start threatening to harm staff, then that door can be locked and they are observed through a glass. So then there's an assessment period. Normally it's about, I've not been working there probably for a year now, so my memory is failing me about a bit, but I think it's the assessment needs to happen around within 24 hours.
Okay.
So then mental health professionals come and do an assessment to see whether the patient needs hospital admission, and if they do, whether they've got the capacity to kind of consent to it or whether they need to be detained.
Okay. And it's always the police that will deliver somebody to a 136 suite, to a place of safety?
Yeah, okay. It tends to be.
And in your experience, are they always available, these 136 suites, or places of safety, you know?
No. So that can be quite variable. But there are situations where they aren't available. And then often patients then have to stay at home waiting for a place, or in worst case in A&E. And it does sound like something that's really, really stressful.
Well, while you were talking, I was thinking about a 136 suite I saw on Twitter, and it was through a camera, and basically it feels, you were talking about professionals sitting with somebody in distress, and there seems to be a move for technology to overtake that and to monitor people from another room.
I saw that on Twitter as well, and my first thought was that's imprisonment. That's a prison, isn't it?
Yeah.
A prison cell where you're shut away. That doesn't, I don't understand how that can be called any sort of care.
It didn't fit with care for me. And you were talking about hospital wards not being therapeutic environments. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I suppose they are busy, noisy environments. There's a lot of patients there. So most units, I think, tend to be around 18 patients. And all of the patients are very unwell normally, because you don't tend to end up in hospital if you're not very unwell. So there are lots of patients who are distressed, shouting out, or kind of... And I've always found that environments themselves are not that therapeutic. They're not beautiful places.
Sure.
There's often not a nice garden space, or there might be no outdoor access at all. And it's just, I suppose they're hospitals and they look like hospitals. And yeah, it's just kind of, it varies how much there is kind of like availability of therapeutic activities, what the staff is like, what the environment is like. But yeah, to be kind of distressed, and I mean, I've experienced this myself, of being distressed and then being surrounded by people whose distress to me might seem really scary. So yeah, it's a difficult one. How could they be more therapeutic?
Yeah. And they're built, do you think, to manage risk, to stop people hurting themselves or others?
Absolutely, definitely. But there are other aspects as well, that there's like often complicated reasons for why there's no more garden space. And I think, again, the risk comes in that there can't be trees with kind of points for... hanging anything off.
Hurting yourself, so that
nobody can hurt themselves with that. So it is really difficult. And then there's also the issue with that. I know from lots of both community settings and inpatient settings where the staff have made a real effort of making the place really homely and really nice. And staff have even bought stuff with their own money to bring nice things in. And then some patients have just trashed the place. And... you know, when that happens all over and over again, there's
not going to be
money around. Yeah. So it's difficult. So it has to be functional, I suppose. So it has to be safe.
Yes.
But it also has to be an environment that's not easy to break and
mess
in. Because food often flies around, and you know, but TVs are broken.
It's a bit like the whole. It's a bit like the whole class getting detention when somebody misbehaves, though, isn't it?
Exactly, and that's exactly what it is.
That's
it's a tricky one. There's no easy answers to these questions.
No. Again, while you were thinking, while you were talking, I was thinking about people who come in as voluntary patients, I've got a horse in this race. They're brought in as a voluntary patient, and then they're told if they try to leave the ward, they'll be sectioned.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that as a process?
Well, it's not meant to be something that should be used. It's not, I mean, it's not legal to be, you know,
that was my thought.
It's not really, if you'd ask any kind of like mental health law experts,
yes,
I'm pretty sure they would tell you that you can't say somebody is a voluntary patient, but if they try to leave, you'll actually then be detained. It just doesn't, any logic.
Are you only voluntary because people can't be asked doing the paperwork that would involve sectioning, or you know, what is the thinking behind it?
It's a difficult one, I suppose. Yeah, and I'm not sure if I have answers to that one.
It's a really
tricky one, because I suppose it depends on the individual case as well, but it should never be used as a threat. That's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. So we've got these hospitals, and we've got I mean, again, you talk about them not being therapeutic environments, and that's striking. And one of the things that really jumped out for me was the funding. You know, I think we dance around funding at times. And if you look at funding per person, healthcare funding per person in the UK, the figures are from 2019. It was the equivalent of £4,653 a year per person per year. Yeah. Whereas in the United States, that figure is $11,072. So it's wow. not quite yeah. three times as much, but it's not far off it. I mean,
yeah.
can you imagine what we could do if we doubled what we were?
Yeah, that's true. But I also still feel like, so the funding would definitely need to be higher, but also I'm sure it could be used more effectively.
Sure.
The systems are just so huge around that, you know, the number of staff, kind of like non-clinical staff that works for the patient, it's just so huge.
With you wondering what on earth are you doing? Like, yes. Why are you sending me emails?
Yes. Yeah, basically.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, my feeling is that the more squeezed a service becomes, the more financially inefficient it becomes. Because
probably.
you spend all your time pushing people away and saying some other organisation, firefighting, and as opposed to, I don't know, I really struggle not to hold Finland as my land of milk and honey. You know, and when you were describing the mental health services and how accessible they were and how nimble and reactive they were, you know, I'm guessing the services there, I think if we looked at comparable healthcare spending in Finland, it'd be similar to the UK.
I'm not sure, actually. I've not looked into the money they spend.
Yeah.
And obviously, as well, I keep thinking I'd really like to go and spend a bit of time in Finland to kind of look at what the situation is there, because I do hear a lot of complaints from people working in mental health services there, especially from patients saying the services are not fit for purpose there.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm not sure how good the situation is anymore.
Right.
It's really difficult to say, but sometimes I just, I suppose it's easy to look at things from 10 years ago and kind of like with rose-tinted glasses and everything was much better, and things are not that straightforward. Things are often complex, but I just still often think that, you know, why can't it be more simple? And I'm thinking, for example, when days and how I think a lot of patients find them quite distressing experiences. But more recently, I've heard, and when I've worked with crisis teams, they've started using these kind of crisis houses where people go and stay for up to 7 days.
Yes.
And when patients have come back from those days, they've said it's been really useful.
Yeah.
And I've kind of thought, well, why? You know, because I've not really heard many bad experiences from those places.
Sure.
So I'm thinking, why do we even have this inpatient system? Why not something like that? And why are we not kind of like putting more effort into prevention and kind of like, you know, more money into GP services and sort of helping people on an early stage rather than kind of like no help at all. And then when it gets really, really bad, then kind of like go in all guns blazing.
I think that is the problem with the current system, is that we locate madness in the person when what's going on around them, you know, it would drive anybody nuts. You know, that from poverty to lack of housing to food poverty to fuel poverty to unemployment to...
Absolutely. And trauma. I think trauma is absolutely huge. So from my experience, I'd say it is a huge majority of mental health patients who've experienced some sort of trauma. And yet how much the services focus on trauma is actually not that great. And I feel like, you know, that why is there more kind of like, why is there not more specialist trauma services? Why are we not all trauma focused services? It's really difficult.
Is it because we're dealing with a culture that doesn't talk about trauma? They talk about personality disorder, perhaps.
Yeah, possibly. And I mean, it has huge stigma
around
it, even though if you'd actually spend time with a person, listen to their story.
Absolutely.
There is nothing. You would, it's difficult to understand where the stigma comes into place, because there's often huge trauma and your heart breaks when you listen to these stories, and then the symptoms completely make sense.
Completely, yeah. And it's just a matter of listening, isn't it?
Again, exactly.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah, exactly.
So that leads us neatly onto a technical matter, the ICD-11, and how people with personality disorder are going to be dealt with in the coming years. Do you have thoughts on mild, medium and severe personality disorder and how that's going to work? And,
oof.
we've only got another 9 hours to go, but...
Yeah, exactly. It's, again, I feel like these are all difficult areas. There's no easy areas, is there? But this is one of my kind of topics that are closest to my heart.
Sure.
And it is a difficult one. The whole personality disorder as a word.
Yeah.
It's just, it feels so harsh, and it just doesn't feel like it really describes the problem at its heart.
No.
But it is a problem of culture just as much as it is of the diagnosis. So I think, I'm not sure what to think here, because I sometimes think if we change the name of the problem, would that change things, or would the stigma just carry on? But then if even words are important, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then if even the name described kind of what this is about, which is trauma.
Yes.
You know, not obviously trauma as kind of like abuse or whatever. It could be just attachments sort of slightly gone wrong. But if the name already described it a little bit better, would our attitudes change as well? I don't know.
Because you hear personality disorder and you immediately think manipulative, attention seeking, don't you? And as you say, there are thousands of great people in mental health services who don't treat people this way.
Yeah.
And yet we all know people who do.
Yeah,
and I think
definitely.
The bad things happen when good people don't react, I guess. You know, what are we doing to stop that? Do we just let that slide when somebody's prejudicial? You know, I know I have in the past. I mean, I tend not to now, but I've let some really dodgy practice go past me.
Yeah, and it is really difficult. And it's difficult. I've definitely been in those situations, and I've been in situations where I've challenged people.
Brilliant.
I've also been in the situations where I've sat quietly. And it can be kind of, because it can be very subtle.
Yes.
And it can be situations where you only think afterwards that, hang on, that was not right.
Yeah.
It can kind of creep on you. And I've been in situations where patient has been really struggling, but I've started kind of struggling as well, that, you know, some behaviours can be... sort of that type that it almost kind of pushes you away as a professional.
Yes.
So you can get pulled. And I think the key there is like just psychological awareness, I suppose.
Yeah.
Teams that are healthy, where staff is not struggling already.
Yeah.
So I think this sort of situations that are quite complex psychologically, it needs to have a healthy team with really good supervision and kind of just healthy dynamics where things are called out.
And that's key, because I was really shocked to find that mental health nurses don't have to have clinical supervision.
I'm not sure about that, because I haven't really worked anywhere where they hadn't had clinical supervision. All the places where I've worked, all the nursing staff has had supervision.
Right. So that's great to hear, because it's shocking to think that can, or if you have it frequently, it's almost seen as a weakness in some cultures, and I mean in some NHS cultures, I mean.
Yeah, no, in the places where I've worked, it's been
fantastic.
Kind of a regular thing that's had. But I suppose that doesn't sort it out completely, because, I mean, if I'm thinking that I've been caught up in some unhelpful dynamics, say I've become really cynical towards a certain patient or certain patient group, and I've started thinking in a way that, these people are just attention seeking.
Sure, sure.
If I don't have the insight to realise that this is what I'm doing, I'm not going to be taking it to supervision.
Right.
So
right.
I suppose supervision often runs in the way that I'll bring a topic there saying, I've really been struggling with this one issue, that could we talk about it? But if I don't realise I'm struggling with something, then it's difficult to address it.
Or you don't want to address it because... I don't know. I suppose, supervision needs to be supportive and challenging, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I suppose it needs that. I feel like with psychological issues, it puts both patients and staff to such vulnerable position. And we're dealing with quite sensitive areas,
even
from staff's point of view. So the supportive environment is everything.
Yes.
So if staff doesn't feel safe and kind of like know that, if I'm going to be challenged, it's going to be in a positive way and in a way where I'm not going to feel too vulnerable and kind of attacked.
Yeah.
And, if there isn't that, then it's just not going to work.
So it's interesting. We often ask patients to mentalise. And I think it'd be useful if we focused on staff as well and said,
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%.
Think about yourself, the culture, I don't know, the overall structure of how we support people with
absolutely
mental ill health.
Yeah.
Or trauma.
And I think I've often used I don't tend to disclose my own personal experience of mental ill health with patients because it's not the space where we are to talk about my health. It's the patient's space. But I have used it quite a lot with staff and colleagues. Where I have seen, for example, people talk in a bit of an unhelpful way about people with personality disorders, I've then kind of disclosed that I've had these similar sort of problems. When I'm in distress, this is how I can behave, or, these are the behaviours I might kind of use. And I think that's often been really helpful, that then, because the staff that I'm working in, that I know that they like me and respect me.
Yes.
And then when they realise that actually it could be me there instead of that patient, I've noticed that they then stop a little bit and think, oh, hang on, all right.
Nice one. When I got my label of borderline personality disorder, my ex-boss told me I was too nice to be a borderline. Wow, where do you go with that? You've obviously gone through that boundary and said, look, I experienced some of my behaviours can be when I'm distressed.
Yes. Absolutely.
And you like me, so I'm part of that group. And I suppose the danger with prejudice is, well, you're not like the others. You're nice.
Yeah.
So I think, but that certainly feels like a toe in the door.
Yeah, and is it that you're only allowed to, like experience distress, and you're only allowed to get help if you're being nice.
Yes.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Qualifying important box in the assessment is the patient nice tick.
Yes, well groomed.
Yeah.
Presentable, nice. Yeah. You'll get referrals saying this lovely person, and you, I don't care if they're lovely.
I know.
I just want to know if I can help them in any way.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It feels like I've danced around the questions that I wanted to ask you, and it's been brilliant talking to you. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that you feel that I've just missed completely?
No, I think we've covered a lot of ground with these topics.
Yeah. I was just thinking that we were talking about the times when you notice that you're feeling mentally unwell, and when you feel less upbeat, and part of me was thinking, you know, that surely at times that must be a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances. It sounds like, you know, on the coal face, you're experiencing hardship both from the punters, but also from the staff and the environment as well. So, you know,
absolutely. And do you know what? I sometimes think, well, I often think that though in the current circumstances, especially, you know, with what's going on just generally out in the world, in our personal lives, at work, you know, a lot of us are having a really hard time. And I sometimes feel like that, isn't it that actually the only normal people in this world are those who are struggling with their mental health? Because how is it normal not to react to everything that is going on?
Yeah.
So actually, all of us with mental health problems are normal, and all the rest of them are very strange.
Well, I think all the rest of them are just people we don't know that well, because I think you scratch the surface, and I think everybody's got their struggles.
Yeah. I think you're probably right.
So, okay. I'm so reluctant to finish this because I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, me too. It's been great.
But I'll just say thanks ever so much for coming on and letting people walk a mile in your shoes. Thanks very much, Sonia. Okay. Bye for now.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.
Thank you so much to Sonia for giving me her time. I don't know about you, but my conversation with her started to fill me with hope that someday we could all work together to dig mental health services out of the hole it finds itself in. Before I get all Martin Luther King on you, you can find Sonia on Twitter at Sonia Cowling. She's well worth a follow. On that very topic, if you've enjoyed today's podcast, please give it a like. And if you want to hear more, subscribe. There are 22 more for you to dive into. Go on, it'll give me a warm, fuzzy feeling inside. If Twitter's your thing, you can find me at Walkamile UK. If it's not, then I'll stick up links to our rather lovely Facebook group in the blurb. In the next episode, I've got some interesting, I know, you'll be the judge of that, updates on my status as the mental diabetic. Keep your eyes, ears peeled. Until the next time, I've been Chris Young, and you've been rather lovely. Walk a mile.